Okay, well, look, many of us will have just come from the session with Barbara Shaw, a woman from the Northern Territory, an Aboriginal woman who's been standing up against the racist Northern Territory intervention there. That's a good segue, in a way, because I want to start, actually, this talk by winding the clock back about 200 years to tell you another story, a story of a man, an Aboriginal man, who lived in the Hawkesbury River area of New South Wales, a man by the name of Pemulwuy. And Pemulwuy was amongst the first leading Aboriginal resistance fighters against colonial Australia. He lived around, as I said, around the Hawkesbury River, along with his country people, in relative harmony until, of course, they came face to face with the brutality of British colonialism. In the earliest years of white settlement in the late 18th century, Pemulwuy ferociously waged a guerrilla war on the young colony of New South Wales. This war was in response to the invasion of his country, the indiscriminate murder of his people by bloodthirsty soldiers, and the destruction of his people's environment and food sources caused by rapacious colonial expansion. Pemulwuy planned and carried out several lightning attacks against the European settlements in the Parramatta and Toongabie areas, and this guerrilla war of resistance between 1794 and 1802 saw losses on both sides. Although, like so many of the previous battles in this country, the number of Aboriginal people that were killed in the battle was about 10 to 1. Josephine Flood, an author, in her recent book titled The Original Australians, tells us that, quote, Pemulwuy became notorious for raids, violence and arson. He headed every party that robbed the maize grounds and burnt the wheat fields. Pemulwuy was a strong, charismatic leader, with a fierce determination to rid his land of European settlers. He was able to organise his people into a force of more than 100 warriors. And the early governors of the colony in New South Wales recognised Pemulwuy as a threat and sent large parties of soldiers to protect the settlers along the Hawkesbury River region. Governor King, who was the last of the ferocious governors that Pemulwuy contended with, was a particularly vicious and pernicious individual. And I guess if death was not already a sufficient means to suppress the indigenous population, when Pemulwuy was finally captured by King's soldiers in 1802, his head, sadly, was severed and returned to Britain in a bottle of pickling fluid. And, you know, this was ostensibly for research in the British Academy, but really this was just a sick, violent, racist trophy sent back from one of Britain's conquested lands. But Pemulwuy's battle was not won in vain. After the war, Governor King turned to a different strategy of trying to co-opt the local people, to cooperate with the local Aboriginal people. But importantly, he was also forced to agree that there should be no more settlements along the lower Hawkesbury River. And of course, this was one of the first significant setbacks for the early colonial expansion in Australia. Now, conventional history, of course, has totally rewritten this story. It's not the version in our textbooks that what I've just told you will not be what you read. And, you know, the kind of whitewash version that we read is one where Governor King is made out to be this great nobleman who was the person who banned settlers, these nasty settlers, from indiscriminately killing Indigenous people. But I think, frankly, we have to see that the winding down of outright violence and repression was really forced upon Governor King by his fear of a continuing an all-out war with the traditional owners of that land. And so we see that the violence of Pemulwuy's fighters did not beget violence, but rather it ultimately created less violence from the side of the oppressors. Now, with that story in mind, and I guess I'd argue like so many, many stories in history as well, I want to now turn to some of my more substantive argument. Now, we live here in a world where the measure of injustice and wrong is immeasurably high. We live in a profoundly violent world today. Every day we see the terrible violence being inflicted upon the people of Iraq and Afghanistan by the sanguivores of the Western military. We see the further lingering threat of war in Iran, in North Korea, in Pakistan. We see the inhumane treatment and torture of refugees and political prisoners. We see the use of flesh-eating white phosphorus or the deliberate targeting of civilians in the recent Israeli war against the people of Gaza. Then there's the violence of the state that killed or brutalised with guns, baton and tear gas all of those courageous protesters who determinedly stood up to the G20 meeting of world leaders in Britain just last week. And of course, we see the violence inflicted on our planet, which many of you will have heard about this morning, as oceans rise, as Antarctic shelves the size of countries break up and melt and flood small islands, as polluted rivers turn frothy brown muck into the oceans, as oil spills destroy ecosystems, and as indigenous populations, as we just learned before, are displaced to pillage the radioactive minerals from beneath their feet. And I guess these are just some of the more obvious and overt forms of violence that we see in the world. Less naked, perhaps, is the violence of the state that forcibly evicts mortgage defaulters from their working class homes, or perhaps the bosses who put workers out with the wheelie bin in recessions, not least of which it was also at times of the so-called normal labour market. We see the oppression oft hidden behind the racist, sexist, homophobic and property-centred policies of statutes, ordinances, policies, laws and even constitutions of nation-states. We see the sheer inequality of resource distribution in a world where commodities are abundant, but millions are compelled to live on millet, to live on dust, or in many cases, to just die. There are millions who die each year in sub-Saharan Africa alone from HIV, while drug companies build fortunes by depriving the same people, the same sick people, of their high-margin patented treatments. And in light, I guess, of all of this violence and misery that I've tried to spell out today, I guess, is it any wonder that a great number of those who reject the logic of this world crave for a non-violent solution to this violent and oppressive reality? And whilst I think socialists would sympathise with any such repulsion towards this kind of violence, we reject that such an idealist approach as principled non-violence on our side can actually deliver a world of genuine equality, freedom and indeed peace. But what, I guess, really underscores this argument that people make for non-violence, this idea that, you know, we can only struggle, we should only struggle in peaceful, non-violent ways. Well, firstly, I think the argument encapsulates a sense of powerlessness, a sense of meekness in the face of a brutal and really powerful capitalist system. But then I think the argument also embodies a sense of deference, a sense of bowing down to those in control of the system at the moment, the capitalists, of course, and their violent state machines. From this standpoint, appealing to those in power seems the only possible alternative. In other words, if you trace the logic of the argument sold by the peddlers of non-violence, we would have to conclude that if we behave in morally virtuous ways, if we restrain our supposedly primeval urge for violence, then our rulers can be persuaded to do the same. Our non-violence, so the argument goes, would beget their non-violence. But I think this argument is deeply, deeply and fundamentally flawed. And I think it also misses entirely any understanding of the reality of capitalist relations. And I think it also tends to point the finger to blame for violence to those who really would seek and have an interest in standing up against it. Capitalists muster violence against the oppressed in this world not because they desire to, in the most narrow sense, nor because their kind of primitive, genetically hardwired instincts are kind of bubbling to the surface in some irrepressible way. But instead, it's because capitalism as a system, its survival means that the system must employ violence. Violence is necessary and at times a desirable strategy for our rulers to keep ordinary people like ourselves in our place. And that place is one of being oppressed, of being exploited, of being divided, and of being demoralised. Those who argue for non-violence as a principle fundamentally reject a revolutionary strategy for changing the world. They accept that the world can only be changed if our rulers are morally persuaded to change it. And socialists, again, reject this argument outright. After all, this world will only improve if those who have no vested material interest in a violent world are able to fight to control it at the direct expense of our peace-loathing ruling class. Capitalism is, after all, a system in which a small minority of humanity, the capitalists or the ruling class, own and control everything, while the vast majority of us, the working class, produce everything and get very little in return. This class division is a fundamental fact of capitalism, and you can't have capitalism without it. And I think no system that is based on the exploitation of the overwhelming majority by a tiny minority, no system based on such an unequal and exploitative relationship can maintain itself without violence and coercion. It follows, therefore, that the smooth operation of capitalism, the system demands that the working class needs to be taught to submit to these relationships. We're taught that it's human nature to live in class stratified societies, despite the fact that such societies have only existed for minuscule proportions of human history. We're taught that the only way to get change is to look to these supposedly beneficent rulers to reform the system. And most importantly, we're taught that there is no alternative to this system. So why bother trying to create change? Because really, it just leads to violence. But people don't usually just submit to these relationships or just kind of uncritically accept this state of affairs. On a regular and a periodic basis, we get huge, massive surges in conflict as people stand up and say, enough is enough. And it's this inspirational process that we in Socialist Alternative recognise is actually gathering pace in the world today in response to the crackdown that's happening because of the world economic meltdown. When the pro-capitalist ideas we're taught are discredited or rejected, the ruling class can turn to more drastic measures. The bosses and politicians have to rely ultimately on guns and force. That's why workers on picket lines, for instance, or protesters in the streets, are so frequently met with violence, and those, in particular, the violence of those who are on the front line of enforcing the ruling class order, the police force. And after that, those same protesters and strikers face submission before the boss's judiciary and the courts, and then they have their humanity robbed by the anti-human jail system. These are the naked realities of capitalist rule, realities which must be faced honestly by all those who seek to change it. And what I want to argue this evening, I suppose, is that social change, be it winning reforms under the current system or revolutionary change, either way, that these changes always involve some form of violence. Not because of the nature of the morality of those of us who are pushing for these changes, and nor is it because of the content of the changes themselves. Far from it. The violence always comes from those who want to stop such changes from happening. The violence is because those who want to see society continue down the barbarous path it is currently on, those like Obama or Rudd or Murdoch, or the heads of, you know, some of the big companies, these people will do anything to protect their power and privilege against any of us who would think to challenge it. But the question of pacifism, or of whether to kind of adhere strictly to this mantra of non-violence, of non-violent political action, is not a new phenomenon. But instead, it's a question that always arises when there is any kind of challenge to the existing order. Frederick Douglass, who was a great African-American freedom fighter, recognised the true dynamics of violence in the necessary fight for a better world. Douglass was born in 1818 in America, and he was born into slavery. He escaped his bondage at age 20 and spent the rest of his life struggling to win freedom of other black slaves in America through both illegal and legal means. And Douglass said these very, I think, very intuitive words about this question. And if you indulge me, I'm just going to read a quote. Douglass said, "Let me give you a word of the philosophy of reform. The whole history of progress of human liberty shows that all concessions yet made to her august claims have been born of earnest struggle. The conflict has been exciting, agitating, all-absorbing, and for the time being, putting all other tumults to silence. It must do this or it does nothing. If there is no struggle, there is no progress. Those who profess to favour freedom and yet depreciate agitation are men who want crops without ploughing up the ground. They want rain without thunder and lightning. They want oceans without the awful roar of its many waters. Power concedes nothing without a demand, and it never did and it never will. Find out just what any people will quietly submit to, and you have found out the exact measure of injustice and wrong which has been imposed upon them. and these will continue till they have resisted with either words or blows, or with both. Men may not get all that they pay for in this world, said Douglas, but they must certainly pay for all they get. And indeed, our side often does pay. Pemulwuy, who I spoke about earlier, unfortunately paid the ultimate price for the right to have parts of his homeland left unsettled by the brutal governor king. But his fight was right and just. And this example is but one of many in human history which shows that those in power do not give up that power without a fight. But this does not mean that it is impossible to win some gains and progressive reforms from the ruling class without being killed. But it does mean that we must fight. To win anything is substantial. Even the limited wins we can have under capitalism are born of some kind of struggle. Take, for example, the universal right to vote, which so often we take for granted, which was only really won through a long and hard and often violent campaign of working class mobilisations and strikes in Britain. Sometimes victories are gained with very, very relatively little opposition from the ruling class, while at other times the victories can be hard fought and bloody. Ideas and actions do not exist in an abstract world removed from the specifics of a struggle. Violence, like non-violence, is a tactic, and in different circumstances, either may be appropriate. Socialists do not mindlessly glorify violence. In the same way, we do not mindlessly condemn it. But we acknowledge that, as Douglas said, power concedes nothing without a demand. We, instead, look at the specifics of the violence, of who imposed the violence, what the demands of the struggle were, and what the effects of that violence will have on the dynamic of the movement. In contrast, though, to Frederick Douglass and our own understanding of the need for violence was that of Mahatma Gandhi, which I understand some of you may have read a little bit of this pamphlet in preparation for this talk. I saw it on the reading list for today. And Gandhi is often held up, of course, as the kind of high priest or the great leader of, you know, of the non-violent movement. And it's often assumed that the movement that existed in India to get Britain out of India was a successful non-violent movement. I want to argue today, though, that nothing could be further from the truth. The effect of Gandhi's philosophy of non-violence was not to stop violence, but to encourage the British and, to some extent, the Indian state to be as repressive as possible. The capitalist state did not concede to Gandhi's morality, but rather stepped up the violence against the movement. Furthermore, it was not Gandhi's philosophy, but the rising activity of the angry peasants and workers, which meant the costs for Britain of maintaining its colony in India outweighed the shrinking benefits. Angry peasants burning down buildings of the colonial establishment and workers going out on strike against Britain and its local backers proved the price that the British would have to pay to maintain its colony. And this is the real violence that the ruling class care about, attacks on their profits. It was mass collective action, not non-violence, that drove Britain out of India. Independence, therefore, became inevitable, and the only question was what form that independence would take. Now, a movement that put workers' and peasants' struggle and working class interests at its head could have constructed a united India out of that fight in the 1940s. A united India free from the British. But because Gandhi pulled back from the movement at vital points, such as during working class general strikes in particular, he pulled back because he feared that the movement was getting out of his control and that and because of his pulling back of himself and his supporters, he derailed the popular upsurges and angry peasants and workers, instead turned to opportunist religious leaders in India. And these leaders demanded independence on the basis of partition, and that is the division of Hindu India and Muslim Pakistan. Now, in amongst all of this chaos, millions were murdered in religious violence, and the disastrous partitioning between India and Pakistan is the legacy that we are left with today. Gandhi made the mistake of arguing that violence was simply a moral question, and therefore equated the violence of the capitalist state with its organised military and its advanced technology with the violence of capitalism's victims. He failed to see that the violence of the oppressed can in no way be measured against the violence of the oppressor. The slaves who strike back at his or her owner to be free they do so justly. Those fighters for liberation must make victory their commitment and see violence instead as a tactical question. But to achieve a real victory, we must also recognise that when the oppressed resist and fight back, violence can seem and often is the most combative and strategic method to employ. It can seem the only logical reaction to the violence of the oppressor. Amongst the masses of India in Gandhi's time, just as amongst the struggles of African-American slaves, the often implacably violent struggles of these oppressed people was crucial for intimidating and disabling their oppressor opponents. When oppressed people resist with violence or not, it is so much better that they have resisted than not. And it is not for us to be sententious about how such resistance should occur, but instead to support it when it does. In order to get rid of capitalism, we need to change the way in which society treats the majority of people who live in this world, the working class, the people who do all the work and who produce everything under capitalism. This transformation can only happen by ordinary working class people seizing control of the political and economic institutions of power in our society. The only way this can happen is by getting rid of the existing state machine mechanics. And after all, these state mechanics are only there to back up the rule of the existing ruling class. And in its place, workers can create a socialist state, a truly workers' democracy. But this is only possible, as I'm sure we've touched on in many sessions this weekend, through revolution, which involves the mass non-compliance of workers in the process of production for capitalist greed. The working class can build socialism if it can overthrow this system, and the only way to get socialism is by revolution led by the working class. No other class has the working class's power or its natural propensity towards organisation around the principle of solidarity. While the ruling class relies on violence to maintain its rule, workers have a lot more on our side. Our social power lies in the fact that we are the ones who produce, for example, the food, electricity, and transport that people need to live. We must also recognise that to win a better world, our most crucial weapon is one which we could hardly call a violent one. For workers, our ability to withdraw our labour or to strike and to affect and disable the production of capitalist profits and to organise this action around revolutionary ideas and practice, these are in fact our most dangerous weapons against capitalism. And this is what gives the working class its power, is that it can stop production and it can stop the flow of profits. So it's not the size of the tanks and guns under our control or how good we can kind of be involved in street fighting and that kind of thing, but in fact the working class's role in production, which means that the working class can, and I believe will, take power. What this means is that even though violence will occur in the process of social change, it is not violence that will determine the success or otherwise of a revolution, but rather the social factors that I've just mentioned. So it should come as no surprise that working class revolutions are actually tend to be much less violent than those which have brought to power the minority capitalist classes in the English and the French revolutions much earlier. But whilst the struggles that capitalism creates daily are important steps towards fundamental change, it is only by mass working class revolutionary movements that this victory can be achieved. But it's one thing to create a mass movement. It's another thing to win. And to win a revolution, to actually beat the capitalist system. Workers are up against not only a ruling class and a state that exploits and oppresses them and represses them generally, they must contend with the military power of those nation states as well. As I've said, the ruling class is a tiny, tiny minority. Therefore, they need to recruit from the working class those people who they rely on to keep their power in place. And as we've seen so clearly from the US military fighting in Iraq recently, the military is overwhelmingly recruited from the working class, and particularly the poorer sections of the working class. What happens when the ruling class calls on these people to shoot at other people in the same situation that they came from, people from working class, other workers, or perhaps, you know, to shoot on their fathers or their sisters or their friends or their lovers, or, you know, strangers who are really from a very similar situation from them? Even today in Iraq, we see how difficult military discipline is to enforce. Joshua Keyes, who's from an organization in America called Iraq Veterans Against the War, has written a book about his desertion experience from the American Army. And he said a few things about this question. He said, "I owe an apology and one apology only, and that's to the people of Iraq. I apologize for doing the things I did completely, but as far as being to the US government, no, no, because they lied, they falsified, and they're the ones that put us all there. No, I apologize, and I apologize to one, and that's the Iraqi people." This breakdown of army discipline that can take place is heightened in the highly polarized atmosphere of a workers' revolution. And it only takes a small amount of encouragement in this kind of atmosphere to get sections of the military to decide not to shoot on the revolutionaries, on the workers, and just a little more to get them to actually join sides with the revolution. The case of the Tiananmen Square protests in China in 1989, I think, a case in point. In this situation, where more than a million workers and students protested for democracy and reforms in the repressive state capitalist China. This is how the Time, I'm going to read a quote now, this is how the Time magazine described the protests. They wrote, "For 7 weeks in the late spring of 1989, the modern years of revolutions, the Chinese people took back Tiananmen Square. First a few workers and students and teachers and soldiers, then more and more until more than 1 million had assembled in the square. They set up in the heart of the ancient nation their own world within a world, complete with a daily newspaper, a broadcasting tent, even a 30-foot plaster cover statue they called the Goddess of Democracy. Their spokesmen were 3,000 hungry strikers who spilled all over the central monument to the people's heroes." Now, when the crackdown against the protests occurred, which hopefully people, you know, will either remember or know about, the Chinese government had to bring in troops from outside provinces, from further afield provinces, from Beijing. Areas where some of the mass dissent hadn't yet reached. The local army units near Beijing were considered to be too sympathetic to the protests and the people of the city to be effective. The locally stationed 38th Army was reportedly sympathetic to the uprising. And of course, they were supplied with no ammunition. They were said to be torching their own vehicles as they abandoned the vehicles and joined in the protests. Even in the modern, highly disciplined army of a dictatorship like China, dissent in the ranks can mean the military can come over to our side. During the most successful of workers' revolutions, the Russian Revolution of 1917, the working class were even more successful in winning the army over in great numbers. The Russian socialists, the Bolsheviks as they were known, argued stridently for the demands of soldiers in World War I, demands for peace, for land, for the peasantry, and for bread and better conditions in the cities. In doing so, the Bolsheviks were able to convince soldiers politically to stand against the old order. For workers, political clarity and organisation are just as important weapons in the class struggle as the willingness to defend the revolution. And so revolutions themselves are nowhere near as violent as their reputation suggests. The Russian Revolution, for example, involved only about 10 deaths during the actual insurrection. Furthermore, the creation of workers' power in Russia hastened an end to the gruesome slaughter of the First World War, which claimed 55 million working-class lives in the name of imperialism and far more than have ever been lost in any revolution. Despite the fact that it is always attributed to bloodthirsty workers, the violence associated with revolutions is overwhelmingly the violence of the old rulers mobilizing their army machines to crush revolutions and restore their power and restore their authority. Many more lives were lost after the Russian Revolution as workers defended the revolution against counter-revolutionaries and 12 invading armies than were lost in the revolution itself. This large-scale violence of the ruling class in revolutions is used for political purposes. And if anyone was in the session earlier today about whether revolutions end dictatorship, you'll remember some of the stories that Louisa told about the Chilean uprising and the way that people were systematically picked off there. Violence can help to erase the legacy of an inspiring revolutionary struggle through murdering leading workers, as well as intimidating workers in the future from ever taking such action again. And while I think this is a tragic situation, it is not cause to abandon the commitment to revolution, but to make sure that it is successful next time by learning from some of these past struggles. Knowing how brutal and murderous the old ruling class is willing to be to maintain its rule, and how lethal disorganisation on our side can be, puts workers in a much better position to win the struggle next time, and which actually, overall, reduces the prospect of violence. So it is the social power of workers united in struggle around the world which has the potential not just to stop the production of monolithic war machines, but also to bring the whole exploitative system to its knees. Once this is achieved, then the creative and the productive capacities of workers could be used to build a society in which production is for human need, and war would be remembered only with horror as the distant past epitome of the barbarism of capitalism. And I guess to this end, let's remind ourselves of those very of the very, very realist determination of the Aboriginal fighter Pemulwuy. The violent defensive struggles waged by him and his army of Aboriginal warriors. It was a struggle that laid the basis for the struggle for Aboriginal land rights that we see continuing right here today. And I'll close once again, I think, by reiterating the very evocative words of Frederick Douglass, words written only a generation after Pemulwuy's savage murder. And Douglass once again said, "There is no struggle. If there is no struggle, there is no progress. Those who profess to favour freedom and yet depreciate agitation are those who want crops without ploughing up the ground. They want rain without thunder and lightning. They want the oceans without the awful roar of its many waters." Thank you.